at the Damage Report. It being a Tuesday, you have no idea who's co-hosting the show with me today, but you're about to find out. And it's very exciting, coming to us live from the internet. Dan Evans returns. Dan, how's it going?
Great to be here with beautiful, tremendous fiber internet coursing through my veins, making sure I can provide the clearest picture possible for you. Good to be with you, John.
Exactly. We've got the tech situation mostly worked out. The pre-show bombed thanks to a printer going bad. Dan was just telling me that in the same way that I think, there's a comedian who talked about like when your hard drive gets full of family photos, you just buy a new computer. That's what family albums are now. You're apparently just buying new computers when you get too many tabs on the first one. I think I'm gonna hit that eventually. It's easier than closing them. But anyway, thank you for being here, Dan. We appreciate you being here. We have tried to put together a rundown touching on some of your interests. So we are, of course, going to be talking about Israel-Palestine, all that's happening there. Absolutely horrendous statements coming out of the State Department. But also, what's the deal with Andrew Yang these days? And we're also going to be giving a brief commentary on some quick headlines, including one topic that I know Dan is very much interested in these days, so that should be fun. For all of you in the audience, thank you for being here, regardless of what platform you're on. Please hit the like button and share the stream so that people know that we're live. And you can, of course, send us messages, tweets, comments, chats, super chats, all that as we go, and we will respond during that. For those on Twitch, though, when Brooke is there, let me know, because I have a poll idea that I want to give you. In addition to the regular Tuesday poll that we do, we're going to have a special one for Twitch coming up pretty soon. But that said, a lot to get to, Dan. You ready to launch into this thing?
Yes, but before that, if I could really fast, just plug in one really quick thing. I did a really great interview with friend of the show, Emma Vigeland, on my channel, youtube.com/danfromtheinternet. But on my show, Power Report, you'll definitely want to check that out. And just like, yeah, follow me on Twitter at Dan from the web. But let's get into
it. Awesome. Fact check, former friend of the show. But anyway, no, I'm kidding. No, she's still awesome. It's just that she's on the air right now. How are we supposed to have her on? I just hate this situation. I might have to make this a night show.
I know this is again, but like after my age, but aren't you supposed to, maybe you're not supposed to cross the streams, but it's been a couple decades. Let's try crossing the streams.
It's probably worth trying now. Yeah, maybe we could do a simultaneous broadcast. Okay, we'll have to think about that. Anyway, with that, why don't we launch into the news though? Somehow the situation in Palestine got even worse after the horrors of this weekend with Israel launching airstrikes on the Gaza Strip that killed at least 20 Palestinians, including 9 children. Rights activists and journalists on Monday called out some members of the media for covering the latest developments with language that misrepresents the power dynamics of the region. So we are gonna get to that language, but we're starting off with the facts, because that power dynamic is going to become very clear. I mean, more than 20 people, I'm reading 26, although you know it might be days until we know for sure, have been killed as a result of those most recent airstrikes. And this is coming after their forces for the last few days injured hundreds of Palestinians with rubber bullets, stun grenades, and tear gas at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Now, Hamas fired rockets into Jerusalem. And so the particular, this is kind of a language dynamic, it's a media dynamic that I want to talk about is, and I've talked about this multiple times on the show, is you will always see numbers compared in a very particular way. It's always gonna end up being how many Palestinians were killed versus how many rockets were fired. It's lives on the one side, it's ammunition used on the other side, always. Now, of course, a single rocket being fired is completely unacceptable, particularly when the intent is to kill Israeli civilians. But we can also understand the context that they basically never do. Now, there are reports of I believe one of those rockets injuring an Israeli civilian, which is again, completely unacceptable and entirely counterproductive, because we all know what the result of that is going to be. But we can also acknowledge that when there's a back and forth, a clash, it results in ammunition being fired, Palestinians being killed, not people being killed on both sides. And they use the bigger number of the ammunition to make things seem equal in a way that they very much are not. Morally, strategically, tactically, and all of that. Anyway, we've got a lot more of this, but I want to give you a chance, Dan, to weigh in on how things have escalated over the past few days.
Now, John, before I even start to weigh in, I just want to appreciate you for contextualizing this for the audience in the way that you did. Because yeah, for too often, for most of my life paying attention to politics, it hasn't been contextualized as an imbalanced power dynamic, which this definitely has become, unfortunately. It's a tougher thing for people to come to for a lot of various different reasons, but that has to be contextualized as a power dynamic. The other thing is that with these world news stories, I try to make this as applicable to Americans as possible when they're watching. This is the equivalent to, and this is a pattern of that's happened in a relation to Israel and Palestine in the 21st century a lot, is that you have protests similar to the Black Lives Matter protests that happened earlier last year that happened as a result of some outrage. Usually it's Israeli forces, as they're on the edges of the occupied territories, engaging in some sort of cruel injustice. In this case, more aptly, you had someone who was literally squatting in a woman's house, basically saying that if I don't do this, someone else will, coming from the Israeli side, from a Palestinian woman who just lived there. This was her and her family's house, right? So you have protests that come out of this. The protest response is usually with increased militarized police. Those police act in really violent ways. Again, disproportionate to the protests that are even happening in response to the initial injustice. And then usually Hamas and will respond with weaponry and attacks, and that's true, there's always a response. This is when usually people start the conversation, is that Hamas fired rockets into Israel, so of course Israel has to respond, getting rid of all the other context John and I just mentioned. And then what happens is that Israel uses the fact that they have the biggest, best weapons from the biggest, most powerful governments with the most money to use against this small, less power imbalance threat. So yeah, you have to understand this even before you dig into some of the injustices. And then one of the injustices we just talked on is nearly 20 children. The US does really terrible things too, but the US is paying up for a lot for Israel's military efforts to do these things as well. And so we have to understand that we do these things by proxy, and it's really unfortunate for people who give a damn about human rights.
Yeah. Yeah, whether directly or indirectly with any particular use of weapons, we're subsidizing that. And as was pointed out by Representative Tlaib yesterday, we have chosen, our government, I should say, has chosen, because what American citizen would choose, but our government has chosen to make that funding not contingent on literally anything having to do with anything, including human rights. Bear that in mind. Oh, and also bear this in mind. So we've been through basically this exact situation countless times between Israel and Palestine. So Palestinians throw a rock or something, and then there's devastating violence against them. And so then Hamas shoots rockets, and they are technically rockets, but the media loves to use the term rocket because it makes you think of missiles, and clearly that's not what they are. Because again, any use of it is unacceptable. They are not devastating Israeli neighborhoods or anything with this, so just bear that in mind. It conjures an image that is not true to life really fast, and then there's the airstrikes. So I just want you to bear in mind one thing, and whether this influences you politically or just your moral evaluation of what's going on, those 20 Palestinians plus that were killed, the 9 kids that were killed, when that set of airstrikes was authorized, there is not a single person involved in that process who thought the people who would end up being killed were the ones who fired the rockets. Nobody thought that. The person pressing the button didn't think that. The person authorizing the airstrikes didn't think that. No one in the Israeli government that would be involved in any of this strategically thinks that. It was just, you shot rockets, we're going to kill some people. They're definitely going to be civilians. They're probably going to be kids. None of them will have been involved in the firing of these rockets, but they have to die because it's convenient to send a message, I guess. Sorry, Dan, what were you going to say?
No, I'm glad I let you continue. I was just gonna say that yeah, it's important to acknowledge that there were casualties, and sometimes there are casualties when Hamas responds, but remember Hamas does these responses. But again, it's about the imbalanced power dynamic, all right? Just as when we're upset in the United States when the cops shoot or kill people who are unarmed or people who are children, it's that's an imbalanced power dynamic for the situation. Okay, now take that to a hyper-militarized level where your neighborhood is literally occupied territory and has been, and people people are just moving in. There are these like awful images that are just like searing into my mind of like extremists, admittedly in Israel, the extremists on the right who were protesting or like celebrating as a mosque was burning right near one of the occupied territories. And it's just like, I can't imagine like being just being tolerant of like all religions and all people as they practice them peacefully, celebrating that kind of thing. I know that's the exception rather than the rule, but I think it's also important for like progressives and like the in Israel to like speak up against this as well, very forcefully, just as progressives spoke up against the Trump administration when like the MAGA insane people were like protesting and doing these insane things as well.
Totally. Yeah, and by the way, there are always individuals and organizations in Israel who will speak out against these human rights abuses, and generally they are treated the same way international critics of the particular actions of the Israeli military or government are treated. Any policy-based or ideological critiques are immediately pitched as anti-Semitic, as if the particular political choices of one particular government represents something fundamental to Judaism, which it definitely does not. So yeah. Now I want to turn to the language aspect of this, which we were talking about earlier. Over the past few days, the news coverage of what's going on in Israel and Palestine, there have been the normal sort of mainstream media attempts to pitch this with the sort of vague, cowardly, squirrely language that leads you to imagine two armies fighting in the streets, which is very much not what's going on. But thankfully, there have been some attempts to correct this language. So I want to go to a clip that sort of gets into this topic.
And look, one word you hear a lot when you cover Israel-Palestine is the word clashes. There are clashes between Israelis and Palestinians in Jerusalem tonight. And I get it, it's journalistic shorthand often, but it's a word personally I cannot stand. These are not clashes. In Jerusalem, one side, not the other, is firing rubber-coated steel bullets. One side, not the other, has hundreds of people injured and in hospital tonight. One side, not the other, is having its holy sites raided. And don't get me wrong, there is violence from the Palestinian side too. The rockets out of Gaza today, courtesy of Hamas, for example, which should be condemned as well, especially when they're targeted at Israeli civilians. But the fundamental, unavoidable reality at the heart of this conflict is that there is an asymmetry of power here. One side is the occupier, the other side is occupied. And media coverage, political commentary, international interventions that don't reflect this central fact, yeah, the fact of illegal occupation of the West Bank of East Jerusalem, are all, I'm sorry to say, part of the problem.
Yep. Some of them, perhaps, as he said, just journalistic shorthand. Maybe it's ignorance, they're not thinking about it. But others, I mean, we've been through this too many times, Dan. They know what they're doing. They're making it seem as if it's like this equal, two forces just equally battling it out, which is very much not.
Yeah, and you know, John, I'm usually very quick to jump on a lot of the bad faith actors out there who will take opportunities and tragedies like these and like spend them again in bad faith and use like immediate terms and targets like anti-Semitism, when they'll also in the same segments claim that people are using the term racist too much, when like it's all oppression. We want to be against oppression. Are you pro-oppression or against oppression? Like that should be the main focus. So I'm not even gonna like give them more of my time than even that little illusion. I think, yeah, it's just really, this is terrible, and we need to have like a really stark conversation in the Biden administration, especially considering that, yeah, it's not Biden's fault, but this is after the Trump administration, and such an enabling was given to Netanyahu and the right wing government that he is also trying to spend to his own right wing and his part and his country, because he's facing snap elections year after year after year trying to stay in power, right? So this continuous appeal to right-wing nationalism across the world has to be cut off somewhere. And like, I'm not one for American imperialism. I hope that Biden keeps his word in pulling troops out of Afghanistan, but this is a mess that the US has been like throwing money into. I think this is something that the US should be like involved in working to clean up in a peaceful way that allows, I think, both Israelis and Palestinians to have autonomy.
Yeah, I agree. I think that that's quite reasonable. And I want to skip ahead just to give you one quote from Linda Sarsour, who's been on the program before. She said, "What we're seeing aren't clashes. What we're seeing is the oppression of an apartheid state against people engaged in peaceful worship during the holiest nights of the year for Muslims around the world." And that's how it started. It has gotten obviously far worse since then. God only knows what we'll be talking about in regards to this story tomorrow or the next day, or God help us by Friday. But right now, this is what's going on. And like we said, there can be a distinction. There should be a distinction. Some people use terminology without, you know, thinking about it. And I don't want to seem like a woke insufferable brat or anything, but I don't think it's a terrible thing to occasionally have your casual use of conversation checked and corrected. In the same way that, you know, like the stimulus payments, people talking about how that's a terrible way to talk about what the need for these are. They should be term survival payments, or referring to effectively white gangs and sometimes white terrorist groups as militias, because that's what they prefer to be called. These are things that we can think about and we can evolve and change over time. That said, here's an area we're going to go into where I would have liked some immediate change, actually. The State Department was questioned about what's going on with Israel and Palestine, and I'm not sure if their comments could have been worse. Although we will be talking about what's going on in New York, so maybe it's possible. But anyway, here is a bit of a State Department representative talking about what's going on there.
I want to ask you about Jerusalem, but let's talk about what you said about the principle of self-defense. Does that in any way apply to the Palestinians? Do they have a right to self-defense? Do Palestinians have a right to self-defense?
In broadly speaking, Saeed, we believe in the concept of self-defense. We believe it applies to any state. I don't think that. I certainly wouldn't want my words to be construed as.
I understand. I want to ask you, I don't want to harp on this either, but you know, the Israelis killed 13 people just now. You know, including maybe 5 or 6 children. Do you condemn that? Do you condemn the killing of children?
Saeed,
I'm asking, do you condemn the killing of Palestinian children?
Obviously, and these reports are just emerging, and I understand, I was just speaking to the team, I understand we don't have independent confirmation of facts on the ground yet, so I'm very hesitant to get into reports that are just emerging.
Dan, what are your thoughts?
I mean, he's handing you the thoughts that are just emerging. I understand the facts on the ground can be kind of, you know, difficult when you're early on in the situations. But again, unfortunately, we've done this song and dance before of these strikes and attacks with Israel and Hamas, like back and forth against each other. And just in general, if you've been a spokesperson of any kind, you're doing tragedies, unfortunately, it's part of the job. You kind of know that over time, as like the dust settles, usually the death and casualty count goes up. So like if it's 1, it's bad. If it's 2, it's bad. If it's 20, it's bad. If it gets worse, which it like might very well be. Or let's say, okay, given the benefit of the doubt, they overcounted somehow, it's 15. Do you condemn the killing of Palestinian children or not? Like that was the question. And he, again, At said that, oh, I don't want my words to get misconstrued. Then give us some words that we can't misconstrue.
Yes, totally. And by the way, people are asking who that is. It's Ned Price, a spokesman for it. And other people are saying it's Ned Price. You can also call him Neo Price because he's dodging those questions like someone in the Matrix. Yeah, that was terrible. I get that sometimes initial reports are wrong. And it turns out, by the way, he was right to be cautious. That reporter was asking him to condemn the killing of 5 or 6 children. And had he done that, he would have been wrong, because actually apparently at least 9 kids were killed. When is it ever better than the initial reports? Like, oh, actually reports are showing that the missiles hit rubble and blew them back into a hospital. No, that's never what happens. More people are going to have died, but you chose not to even condemn the smaller number. Now it looks even worse by comparison. And your job as a spokesman, I get it, is to be soulless and to do whatever you're told. But when they say, do they have a right to self-defense? And he basically says, the Biden, come on, man. Like, you know what I'm allowed to say and what I'm not. And like, obviously as a human, I'd prefer for civilians not to die, but I've got a job to do now. That's what that whole thing just screams to me. I'm going to really try not to be devastated by the immoral positions I'm being forced to stand to hold for a paycheck. But the refusal to condemn because he was told not to. Let's keep it real. before he was sent out there, they said, don't give an inch. Israel's allowed to defend themselves. Don't acknowledge Palestine or Palestinians even exist. And if people died, well, that's sort of the situation. Just get out there so that we can say we did a press conference and then end it, okay? But that's not really the way it worked out. And Dan, in a moment, we're gonna have the follow-up for that. But any other thoughts about that first bit?
No, I think that was good. Let's follow up.
Okay, well, it immediately went into this follow-up question. Great questions, by the way, in this press conference. So let's go to this next one.
You're gonna know as soon as I read what your answer was that there's a big problem with it. You said, well, not a problem, it just doesn't answer the question. We believe that it, meaning the right to self-defense, applies to any state. Well, you see the problem, right? Yes?
Do you want to?
Do you regard Palestine as a state?
I wasn't referring.
In the context of the ICC and the UN. Saying that you do not, if it applies to any state, are you saying that Palestinians don't have a right to self-defense?
I was making a broader point, not attached to Israel or Palestinians in that case.
So they do have a right to self-defense.
Matt, I'm not in a position to debate the legalities from up here.
Well, then step down. Honestly, if being up there is a bit of a problem, then step down. No, but I love it's like, does Israel have a right to self-defense? You bet your A they do. They definitely do. What about Palestine? I mean, legalities, and who am I to say above my pay grade? Can't comment on that. It is weird how it really depends, Dan, on which group you're talking about, whether he's willing to say things that are definitive.
I occasionally get into Twitter arguments that go around the idea that people need to raise their standards of journalism in America, because rarely do you see questions like that. Like that, I need to find out that journalist's name. That is incredible. That means like a Pulitzer, means like awards and recognition. That's like it's because like he asks the questions, like Megan Thee Stallion, the questions. Extra E at the end, like seriously. And you just don't get that so often in America, honestly. But like you, I'm glad that he was there to keep him honest. Great mask, by the way, but like it was like a tie-dye color thing. But like he was just so good at keeping him honest. I think the clip is like, rarely does the clip just speak for itself. Rarely can I add like some like hot take above it. But yeah, just like that spokesperson, I guess I'll say this. If you have any assumption in your head, dear viewers out there, that people will not sell their soul and their public image and what they're willing to say for relatively low sums of money, this shouldn't be your first lesson in this, but this should be like the final lesson in that.
Yeah. No, you're totally right. I mean, your comment that sort of like the clip sort of just tells the story. You don't even need the audio in that. Because he failed in like it doesn't bother other people, but it's always like there's one thing that you are in that job, whether you're that guy or if you're Kayleigh McEnany or if you're I'm forgetting her name now, Huckabee Sanders, is control your face. Because when that guy's follow-up question came, Ned started blushing and he was smiling. It's a subtle thing. I get it. He called you on your BS and you knew it. You knew it before the question was even done. But if you go back to that video, he's got the little smile of, oh, you got me, did you? You saw the thing I was doing? You get that, like, you know, as a human, I'm naturally supposed to be against the killing of children, but I have to really try to get through this situation without implying that there's anything fundamentally immoral about killing children. I really have to do that. So if you could back off, that'd be great. Thanks. That's what we saw right there. Oh, and by the way, while we are critical of a lot of different people so far in this show, particularly Israel for the decision to kill these civilians totally needlessly, civilians unconnected to the firing of the rockets, that's our government. And Ned isn't even fundamentally the problem. He's saying what he was told to say. So it's our State Department who has the totally wrong position on this. And are we supposed to assume that the State Department is like giving a big middle finger to Joe Biden? No, Joe Biden, save your empathy. We're gonna stand with the killing of, no. As of right now, since Joe Biden hasn't contradicted what we're seeing from the State Department, this is the position of the Biden administration, that Israel gets to defend itself, states get to defend themselves. So if you'd like to really have it on easy mode, stop a group of people from having a state, and then you can do anything you want to them. They can't do anything back. It's a really sweet situation if you can set it up.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Andrew Yang's mayoral campaign in New York hit a bit of a social media bump when he decided to weigh in on what's going on with Israel and Palestine. Obviously, this is coming in the wake. I believe his tweet was after the airstrikes that killed over 20 Palestinians. But even if it wasn't, it was after the violence in the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the hundreds who were injured. In any event, what he had to say was, "I'm standing with the people of Israel who are coming under bombardment attacks and condemn the Hamas terrorists. The people of NYC will always stand with our brothers and sisters in Israel who face down terrorism and persevere."
And I just want to know if they will also stand with the Palestinians who arguably are facing a little bit of persecution.
And they're being asked to persevere against quite a lot constantly, including as you were sending that tweet, Andrew Yang. Now look, a lot of people, including clearly me, had a problem with that tweet. My favorite response was this meme, "How to slap someone through the internet," which I think really sums it up. Particularly because like Andrew Yang is a very interesting figure. He's a very unique figure. We like to point out that we were one of the first media outlets to interview him during his presidential campaign back for 2020. And we've had a great conversation with him. We've thanked him many times for raising the profile of UBI as a policy being discussed at a national level. That said, this was not a good take and not a lot of people liked it. Although notably, some people did like his stance. You might recognize some of these names like Ted Cruz, who said, "Bravo to Yang for opposing the rabidly pro-Hamas and anti-Israel attacks from fellow Dems Omar and Tlaib." Meghan McCain said, "Hashtag Yang Gang." You didn't already hate that hashtag? I'm betting you're over it now. Anyway, Stephen Miller said, "Andrew Yang is exactly right. Ilhan Omar is outrageously wrong." And so, Dan, I think that if you've got Ted Cruz and Meghan McCain and Stephen Miller, Lord of the Snake People himself, on your side, should have a pretty good idea of how good your take was. What do you think?
Yeah, with friends like these, it's like one of those things, right? But like, yeah, just on a top level, Andrew Yang had the opinion right there in his tweet. That was the kind of opinion you have when you just come into the room super late and you don't understand what's going on for the past 3 hours and you just give your strong take opinion right there. It's the kind of like shoot from the hip thing that Andrew Yang does in his politics. More on that in just a second. But like it's, we just went through and just previously the context of what happened there, the disproportionate like sort of power dynamic that's going on between like Israel and Palestine. The fact that, oh, there's a term called occupied territories and there's like the Gaza Strip. What's the power dynamic in any of these places? Where's the police militarization here? Like whose police are doing what? It's like these questions don't get asked, these deeper things don't get asked. But like this thing was a little bit personal for me, because if we can ready graphic one, Andrew Yang was like the first presidential Democratic candidate, like you said, to come onto TYT. He came on Rebel HQ back when, or the conversation back before it was Rebel HQ. I got to meet him, and like, you know, Bernie was my favorite, and I thought like Bernie and Warren were gonna be like, you know, and this happened by the media. They were immediately lionized by the financial media and said, these are going to be wild socialists who are going to take away your things. But Andrew Yang, he was loved by a lot of media. He embraced independent media very early. Before Bernie Sanders had this whole controversy of going on the Joe Rogan Experience, Andrew Yang went on the Joe Rogan Experience to talk about UBI. And like, Joe Rogan's become an increasingly indefensible person over the years. But to be able to use that platform and that audience to get a bunch of people interested in a fairly progressive idea, at least in theory, is really good. So my overall idea was that, like, my optimistic take was that Andrew Yang could be a Trojan horse because of his malleability on some of these issues. You could, like, I think you could convince him on a lot of things, and he had this broad appeal. And then I, as a producer of TYT at the time, watched the presidential debate that Andrew Yang was doing, and it was just like this. Yes, Andrew Yang didn't get a lot of debate time, but anytime Andrew Yang was asked a question about foreign policy, like, he just had this, I think I described it to you as this naked ignorance to foreign policy combined with a lack of intellectual curiosity in informing himself in debate after debate. So like, not only would he have an uninformed opinion on the foreign policy issue of the time or of the minute that was asked of every other candidate in the debate at the time, not only would he be uninformed about that in the first debate, but after clawing his way to future debates, he would still fail those questions. They wouldn't get any better. So like, I don't think Andrew Yang has the intellectual curiosity to repair a lot of the like things he's saying, even knowing this backlash. But like, in case Andrew Yang is listening, you're fake, you're lame, you're a sellout and a half and a silly son of a bitch. You'd be a terrible mayor of New York, and if you had a political conscience, you'd stop eyeing power and direct wealth better towards people who are better suited for actually having power, instead of wasting New Yorkers' time for your own opportunistic ends. Just stop it, go home.
So we got to answer the question of how to slap someone through the internet. Dun dun. Geez, yeah. Yeah, look, he's an interesting guy. I've had some interesting conversations with him. He has some good ideas. And obviously, he has a form of intellectual curiosity, comes up with some ideas that other people don't. But how he has changed over time, the change in his positions, which ones he's stayed firm on, he seems to not only be malleable, as you say, but malleable by like exactly the sort of people and groups and financial interests that we would not be interested in. And it's not to say that he's the worst guy ever. There are worse Democrats, there's bad people, but this is a terrible take. He has to know how various groups will respond to that. And clearly, he likes how certain groups, maybe electorally significant groups, will respond to it, and not how people who don't want Palestinians to be killed and oppressed will respond to it. And I haven't seen any follow-up on this yet, even despite the huge amount of criticism. So it's pretty bad. Pretty bad, Andrew Yang.
I have one more thing as I've cooled down a little bit, because especially in the context of his run for New York mayor, during when the spotlight was on him as a prominent Asian American politician to speak on the hate crimes that were happening against Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders earlier this year and have happened a lot through COVID-19, his response was more police. His response was increase the militarization, which is what a lot of Asian American and Pacific Islanders activists were not asking for. Because when you increase police militarization, some of the communities that are militarized and heavily policed even more are the more working class Asian and Pacific Islander communities, as well as Black communities, as well as brown communities. So this is a lot of times, like, you know, people, domestic policy and foreign policy, it's all over the place. And he's running for mayor. I don't expect him to know exactly what's going on, even though New York is such a major city in the world, right? Like, of course, he has to know some idea for this, right? And he ran as a presidential candidate. He's got to know. But it shows that he's down, especially this, because there's such a tie between militarization locally that he's fine with of the police and what he's fine with in foreign policy. He's not a good politician to run. He's extremely dangerous. Like you said, John, there's worse politicians for sure, worse Democrats, but he should not be anywhere near the mayor's office.
Yeah. Well, we're curious. Do you think this is going to hurt his chances? You can go to TOT.com/polls, and that poll is up right now, and we'll let you know tomorrow what everyone thinks. But hopefully by then he will have said more. I don't know.
Maybe he'll expect it.
I mean,
maybe he'll read the poll. Maybe he'll read the poll and understand that.
Maybe I've got a response. Let's definitely tweet it to him. But bear in mind, back in January, he got kind of in trouble, less so, but in trouble for comparing the BDS movement to unfair economic punishment like the fascist boycotts of Jewish businesses. So, yeah.
We know the kind of malleable opinions that he can have and who's in his ear on those opinions.
Yeah. Yeah, unfortunately. Okay. By the way, the Twitch poll has finished with unfortunately all of you being manipulated by Dan into voting for the damage report, which was not supposed to be on the poll at all. But anyway, thank you. Thank you. Damn you, Dan. Okay. With that, let's jump into our next topic. Lots more to get to in the limited amount of time that we have here. Okay. I find this battle over the heart and soul of the Republican Party, which has neither, to be fascinating. What is the future going to be? And some are pretty sure. I mean, we're seeing this fight over Liz Cheney. She's almost certainly going to be replaced. I don't know, maybe by Marjorie Greene, it's possible. But I want to talk a little bit about that fight, why it's happening, and where the party is likely to go. A lot of it, I think, is summed up pretty well in this clip. We're going to show you Sean Hannity and Lindsey Graham.
Really, we're talking about the simple agenda, and you and I have discussed this at length. And that is, okay, what do we conservatives believe? Liberty, freedom, capitalism, lower taxes, less government bureaucracy. We want free and fair trade. We want peace through strength, secure borders, energy independence, constitutionalists on the bench, law and order, safety, security, free market solutions to healthcare, and choice in schools. Am I missing anything? Because if I am, I need to be educated.
Now, that's a pretty good American first agenda you just described. And what I said on your show got people all riled up, but it's just common sense. The most popular Republican in America, it's not Lindsey Graham, it's not Liz Cheney, it's Donald Trump. People on our side of the aisle believe that Trump policies worked. They're disappointed that he lost. And to try to erase Donald Trump from the Republican Party is insane. And the people who try to erase him are going to wind up getting erased. It's impossible for this party to move forward without President Trump being its leader, because the people who are conservative have chosen him as their leader. And you know why they chose him? Because he delivered. He was the most consequential president for national security since Ronald Reagan. He secured the border, he cut our taxes, he brought a new attitude of being an American. And the people have chosen him, not the pundits.
Okay, so really fast, I just want to note, he brought a new attitude of being an American is both arguably right and deliciously vague about what exactly that means. But anyway, Dan, they're talking there about why they have to cling to Trump. What do you think about that? Are they right about the base? Any attempt to move on wouldn't succeed? What do you think?
Lindsey Graham told the truth, which is like a rare thing for Lindsey Graham to do. It's just like he was flat out plain and simple. I think the funny aspects of that clip was that like, well, yeah, Sean Hannity and Lindsey Graham were just like kind of yes anding each other there. Like, of course, this is the thing we do. Everything you said was great. And I just, the only thing I kind of took from that clip were the dog whistles that were just littered through there. Like Lindsey Graham was doing like the full Pat Buchanan, if you will, of dog whistles and possible racist like undertones, things you could do. He repeatedly did the line, the America first agenda, which America first even to begin with is kind of like there was Germany first to begin with. Every country with a nationalist sort of framework usually has a country name first sort of mantra. And like you can do things that are for the good of your country and not sort of assert yourself as like the best. There's like undertones that have to be there. But in case you can't be gone there, Trump can't be erased. Like, removed from memory, but like he called the Jews will not replace us guys very fine people. I would be a little bit more careful with the rhetoric there around erasure, considering a lot of Trump's base of people who are like America first and very nationalistic. they are people who are worried about some like mass grand replacement that people on Fox News talk about on a nightly basis. There are nationalist aspects of that. The people have chosen him. That's just like a, there's some sort of fascist undertones within that, because the people very much did not choose him. Only a group of Republicans did, and that group of Republicans didn't beat out, I guess, the Republicans who sat out the race or voted for Biden, because Biden won and is in office now. And the great lie is just something used to get right wingers to sell Patreon subscriptions, essentially. So it's just, it's, I hope people just take this seriously, because something really sinister is boiling in the Republican Party right now, and we called it.
Yeah. So the people chose him. Well, they did choose him in the Republican primary in 2016. The people generally didn't choose him in 2020, though. He lost that election. They keep forgetting that he lost that election. And I guess, like you said, they're trying to get clout and all of that off of the big lie. Right there, it seems like just saying it without saying it, like pretend that he was chosen, that he's still popular and all that. By the way, you can move on from past presidents. The Republican Party doesn't feel deferential to George W. Bush. He won two elections. I don't think most Democrats feel like you should constantly be talking about Barack Obama, although to be fair, Joe Biden did talk about Barack Obama quite a bit. But nobody expects that every national politician is going to model themselves on Barack Obama, and he won two terms. Like, Trump won one without even winning the popular vote, and then lost after being impeached twice. And they're all acting like, well, no, that's just eternal. In the year 3000, we're gonna be dressing up like Donald Trump still. It doesn't have to be that way in theory. And people like Liz Cheney, as reprehensible as they are in general, they still want the Republican Party to be in control. They just think it might be in our interest electorally to move on from this doofus who couldn't win re-election, which seems like there might be a point to that. Now, they might both be right. She may think that with Trump running again, we won't be able to win a national election. They may think if we turn to a different candidate rather than Trump, his base will abandon us, so we can't win that way either. I don't, maybe they're both right, but this fight is, it's sort of sad. The lack of the level of devotion they have to a guy who lost them so much politically.
But the fact is, the level of devotion is true. The fact is, the base is very devoted to Donald Trump. They're not gonna be devoted to anyone else but either Donald Trump himself or someone that he directly ordains, and he's gonna have an opinion about it. I think he had an opinion on the Kentucky Derby and some horse racing recently, all right? Like, he's gonna have random opinions about things all the time. And so he's definitely gonna have opinions on like who is gonna be next in his political dynasty, whether it's one of his like failed children, which I think he said if he lost the election in Pennsylvania that he'd never talk to again. I assume that's going pretty well for all involved. But
it's like a continuing policy.
It would have been a good policy to begin with, would have kept him out of a lot more crime. But like, I do think that getting back to the main aspect of what Lindsey Graham was getting at, this is Donald Trump's party, and everything Donald Trump stood for, everything Lindsey Graham, like Sean Hannity just sort of like rattle off of the teleprompter, how clever of him to throw football. Lindsey Graham just sort of like was like, yes, American force. He secured our borders. He brutalized people at the border is what he really means. What America does Donald Trump and his base stand for? What America is Lindsey Graham and all of these like pundits on the right? What are they enabling? What are they putting into? What are they trying to stoke fear out of to get them to respond? As mass shootings are also rising. There's not a direct correlation there, but I mean, this is a violent country. They're using a rhetoric of fear. And this is when they feel the weakest and they will like squirm the most. So I don't like any of it. And all of these politicians and pundits know exactly what the hell they're doing.
There's a lot of news out there, and we don't have time to delve too deep into all of it. But while we have a limited amount of time with our guest, Dan Evans, I wanted to give an opportunity to give some fast reactions to some headlines, including this. Elon Musk sending Dogecoin into space after his SNL joke smacked it on the nose, talking about him admitting that it's a hustle. Now he's sending it to the moon or something. I don't know what it means to send a digital currency to another planet, but what do you think about this?
There was a good point made on a podcast recently that the reason why SNL and Elon Musk's appearance wasn't funny, I mean, one of the many reasons, but the main reason was that they were giving into the idea that Elon Musk is the grift that he's selling, that he's the super genius Iron Man, whatever. And comedy's supposed to like joke at the truth, which is he's not. He's just like all of these things. He has this like weird history, but it kind of shows the balance of access to power versus telling the truth that unfortunately SNL really does. And truthfully, I didn't even watch any of the sketches because I couldn't bear to do it outside of clips online. And the only good thing about SNL is Michael Che. That's all.
He's funny, but there's other good performers. Anyway, yeah, my only thing, I don't really care about Elon Musk, but I do think that the way that some of the intense speculation in cryptocurrency has popped up is a reminder that we need political solutions to the economic crisis that so many people are facing. The fact that so many people seem driven to, God, I just if Elon Musk will say something, then this thing will shoot up in value. I mean, it's not based on anything, but I can make some temporary money. That is an outgrowth of economic desperation that needs to be dealt with. Insane speculation by out of control billionaires on comedy shows is not the solution to our economic problems. Anyway, next headline, Instagram, Twitter blame glitches for deleting Palestinian posts. So people posting on those platforms about what's happening in Palestine had their things deleted thanks to glitches. Thoughts?
Okay, so I've previously railed a lot about saying cancel culture doesn't exist. And I think the best counter argument to that that I've heard, although I still won't back off of my point because I think it's flashy, is that cancel culture exists for the left. Cancel culture often exists for the marginalized, and you don't see it because of those factors. They are marginalized. We just saw Twitter getting under fire for blocking what's going on, for blocking tweets from journalists in India who are reporting on how the government there is mishandling COVID-19. And so we know that social media and governments, they're trying to, I think social media thinks they're playing internally this game of, we don't want to be involved with governments and accidentally topple them over anymore. But by being any more than the agnostic platforms that they've built, they are in fact directly having an effect in these geopolitical issues. And until they want to actually stand up for that or stand in for that, yeah, again, kind of like maybe the theme of this is it's time to regulate.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, look, I'm sure there's glitches, I guess. A certain percentage of posts are gonna be glitched. And so if there's something a lot of people are talking about, maybe a few of them were honest glitches, but yeah. I'm not buying it. Anyway, yeah. Next headline, the Pentagon inches towards letting AI control weapons. That seems like a great idea, Dan. Just give control over to the mother brain.
Yo, yes, I do believe in giving Skip, the wonderful technical director who is making the show happen, a drone. But if we also could have Skip on the show, he would tell you that this is all magic. Hell yeah, this is all magic, right? Like the fact that this is all working through like Skype and like broadcasting and all thing, this barely works half the time. To give that all to AI, to give it all to like a machine, that's why I don't really even trust self-driving cars that much, because they don't exist yet and they're like really good at killing people. War is a tough thing. What is it good for? Absolutely nothing, of course. But like, I don't think we should let the artificial intelligence with its racial biases that we've yes, very much recorded throughout recent history be in charge of policing or military actions. But maybe let's get Andrew Yang's opinion on it.
Oh God. Yeah, right now, like Skip decides if he wants to go to the one shot of Dan or of me or a two shot. In theory, you could have an algorithm decide that. And that's what happens on like Google Hangouts and stuff. But what if instead of choosing the shot, it was taking a shot? Yeah, I don't know about that. They're definitely gonna do it. They're definitely gonna do it. And it's definitely going to be at least something like every sci-fi movie about robots and weapons that predicts this going poorly. Anyway, finally, news from inside the TYT network from Jonathan Larson. It says, judge orders release of Buttigieg police tapes. I don't know if this is how he's gonna make transportation cool again, but this is probably not the best news for the mayor.
Yeah, I think He's going to use his new spot as transportation secretary to make sure those police tapes get transferred very, very quickly away from the press. Yeah. It's going to be in a nice little USPS, one of those cute little electric vans. It's going to go very, very quickly. It's going to zip away with all
very
the tapes
far and away. No one sees them. Yeah, I think he's going to do a big demonstration where he takes those tapes and throws them under an awesome electric bus. Anyway, those are our quick thoughts on a few things. Yeah. Anyway, we've got a lot of videos, obviously, over the past few years about that story. He didn't end up becoming president, so I guess it's all cool. Anyway, let's roll on to other news. One of the variants of COVID-19 has received an elevated classification based on some new research into its severity and how quickly it can be spread. The WHO has classified the B.1.617 variant as a variant of global concern because it spreads more easily than others and requires further study. The variant has been shown to have spread to 30 different countries already. Now, there are a couple of different classifications of this. So, mutation is elevated from a variant of interest to a variant of concern based on Leonardo DiCaprio in that scene from the movie. Anyway, when it shows evidence of fulfilling at least one of several criteria, including easy transmission, more severe illness, reduced neutralization by antibodies, or reduced effectiveness of treatment and vaccines. So, that is one of the more easily spread variants that's been spreading around the world. It's one of the reasons, by the way, that the US, which has seen a great deal of success in getting down its daily COVID death rate, still has between 40 to 50,000 cases per day. And I am glad that they are tracking all these mutations because we keep talking about this possibility that one is going to be less able to be neutralized by antibodies or potentially by the vaccine. That has not happened yet. Scientists don't seem to think it's incredibly likely, but if it does, it's going to look kind of like this and it's going to spread kind of like this, Dan.
Yeah, it's really unsettling to hear. It really just sort of underscores the efforts needed to make sure that there are waivers to patents that were used to make these vaccines. If taxpayer money was used to generate these vaccines in partnership with these private corporations, then taxpayers of the US government should have some say in what to do with those things. And we should be pressuring the US government to make sure that the world, not because like we want to take over the world, not that the US already hasn't tried to already, but like just so that we can continue international travel and economics and relations and the things we're normally doing getting back to normal. Because like I don't get why I have to explain on a show why having a virus spread in one country can mean it can, yes, it can absolutely spread to another country. It can spread across the world. We saw how bad COVID was, contagious it was at least. We have variants that are even more contagious. There are variants that can become resistant to these things. But I'll also say to the flip side of that is that we saw that science is a fast moving thing and they're learning things preliminarily. And so they're always going to be cautious with the beginning sort of research that they have out there, right? So this is being cautious. These are the worst case scenarios in the times, but we need to still be alert about these things. And I guess the darkest thought I have about all of this is that I hope this doesn't become a justification for more nationalism across the country, or across the world, I mean, and across the country especially, but like saying, oh, well, we shouldn't travel to other countries because we have the vaccine, we being like any of the countries that are like more properly vaccinated, and they, the countries that haven't gotten the vaccine due to all these unequal reasons, have been vaccinated. So we have to protect ourselves and close up our borders, which this could be used as a justification for.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. I mean, notably early on, the first couple of months of the pandemic, something like that was the only way Trump would show that he cared at all about the pandemic. And ever since then, they have had to walk a very careful line where the pandemic is over-exaggerated. It's not a big deal. You don't have to do literally anything to protect yourself. Don't even put cloth over your face. But also, we should cut off all contact with every other country in the world. So those two things simultaneously. And so I share your worries about that being one of the takeaways on the right. And by the way, last thing, I just want to remind people, it was great to see the world and a lot of Americans, including American media, American celebrities, sort of trying to raise money for people who are suffering in India, trying to raise concern about it and raise knowledge about it. By the way, it's still really bad. The country's averaging about 3,800 COVID deaths per day. And that is just the official number. It's not believed to really be representative of how many people are actually dying. Close to 400,000 new cases over the last 7 days. That's up 4% from a week ago. And again, this is in a country that does not have an overwhelming testing capability. So again, that is not representative of the deaths or the cases. So if you thought it was bad a week ago, 2 weeks ago, it is still very much bad. They still need aid. I saw a story, they were asking for people climbing in Nepal, climbing mountains in Nepal, to bring their oxygen tanks back because of how dire the situation is with that. So it's still bad and they still need help.
Can anyway. I super last thing, just really fast. India is very hit hard right now with being able to handle people who have been affected with COVID-19. So like getting oxygen tanks and intubations and all those things that involve with people who are already like diagnosed in the hospital and dealing with the effects. However, India has a very, very good ability to produce vaccines. Some of the best in the world, that has to be pointed out. We just need to be able to help them produce those vaccines they can already produce to get people inoculated so that they don't end up straining the healthcare system like we had to do around the world. It makes sense. So of course we're not doing it.
No, or if we do it, we're gonna drag it out as long as possible and I don't know, a million extra people in India will die over the course of the next 18 months until we finally allow them to domestically produce the vaccine. Okay, that said, we have only a few more minutes. We're gonna roll quickly into, oh, I forgot about the G block. We're definitely not getting the G block, but we're gonna do the F block, okay? We're gonna get to this story because it's a little bit of fun. Hate me if you want, we're gonna do it. Over the past few days, the new trend that's sweeping the nation is the buddy comedy tour of Matt Gaetz and Marjorie Greene on their America First tour. Because remember, the America First caucus, too racist for the Republican Party. The America First tour, it's cool, you can do it. And so they started it off down in Florida and they had a little gathering. The gathering was very happy to see them. So I just wanna play a little bit from that first event. That is the American Clowns First Caucus. Anyway, no, really the music that they were dancing to was We Are the Champions, but we were worried that if we played that, our entire channel would be thrown off of YouTube. But anyway, Dan, that's, you gotta love that. It's this group of old white maskless Republicans who believe that Trump won and are chanting We Are the Champions when Biden is very much sitting in the White House right now.
Like, first of all, whoever made the edit decision to put that music on there, God bless, because I've heard like that TED talk that went around recently from that one right winger who actually had music that was as ridiculous as that. So it's uncanny enough to work. Nice. But like, yeah, I guess I don't want to. Yeah, I'm not gonna make that comment. That's a little bit too edgy. I will say that it is really difficult that a lot of people are just like living this sort of fantasy. But like, okay, fine, you can do that or whatever. I just know that sometimes you get these goofy things where like they're doing like the YMCA dances or whatever, or you get Pete Buttigieg's High Hopes dances or whatever. But not to bring Pete Buttigieg into the conversation for no apparent reason, that's just random slander. But like, I know what, especially on the Trump side of things, this leads to this fanaticism, this like, I will die for my president thing, because we literally started this year with an insurrection of the Capitol. So just forgive me if I'm a little bit cautious of political fanaticism.
Yeah, and some of the politicians who are most supportive of it are the ones that they went to see. So those people in that crowd who all believe that Trump either won and it was robbed from him, or that he won and he's actually the president right now in the White House, a combination of a variety of insane conspiracy theories, they went to an event to see Matt Gaetz and Marjorie Greene. So they went to see the guy who is facing accusations of child sex trafficking. and the woman who they only know because of the Jewish space lasers and the shoot Nancy Pelosi in the head thing. That is who those people are. Now, that said, maybe it was wrong of us to put the clown music and to joke about them. And in fact, one of the articles, I think, was it on Roster or Mediaite, was talking about this. So they had, they pitched it as like that people were being mean and making fun of the people in the crowd. And they had a quote that said, the clip went viral and became the subject of cruel mockery by media figures, celebrities, and other verified Twitter users, some of which centered on the crowd's age and whiteness. And for example, they posted the tweet, crowd mainlining statins and beta blockers waiting for the. Yeah, so that's funny. I don't know for sure if the article is being serious or is being sarcastic, because the headline and that thing is like, and people were really mean to them. Now take a look at 30 of the funniest tweets mocking them, which is the same as just collecting those to mock them. Like, for instance, my favorite one was a tweet from Brian Garr that says, when the cruise announces there's double pudding for dinner. Dancing back and forth. That is funny. Whether you just put it to mock them or say it's mean to mock them, here's funny people mocking them. I feel like that's the same thing, Dan.
Yeah, like there's a whole version of journalism now that's like, this happened, this is a thing that happened. Here was the reaction on Twitter. So like you have to kind of like give into it and like there's that. Mm-hmm. But like I think, yeah, this is a thing that happened on the internet. So you can like remove the context from it and like add jokes around it to make it funny. And they did. That pudding thing really hits different. I wonder if it's vanilla, chocolate, or tapioca. Like what's going on?
I have a feeling most of the people in that room have a problem with chocolate pudding. I'm not saying why or what or anything. I'm just saying. Anyway. Yeah. And so they went to see Gates and Green. Gates and Green are now continuing the tour, by the way. They were tweeting back and forth to each other like publicly when they have each other's phone numbers, I don't know. And like he said something about being her Huckleberry and like, oh, their friendship. Somehow, like I feel like they both can do better. But anyway, yeah, it's a sucky part of the movement. This is a very important part of the Republican Party going forward, though. People in that room dancing, that is a significant part of their base in ideology, if not some of the demographic factors. So. Anyway, Dan, that is unfortunately all the time we have. I want to thank you for joining us. It's always fun to have you back. Hopefully we can have you back in studio at some point. Your presence is still missed.
I miss you very much. Miss everyone there. Hopefully, yes, we're very close to the end. If everyone just gets their shot, please. Yes. Talk to y'all soon.
Now, wait, hold on. Where can people watch your show? We've alluded to a couple of the episodes. Where can people see it?
Oh. Yes, please. So go to youtube.com/DanFromTheInternet, especially if you're on YouTube right now. And check out the newest episode, Power Report 26, The New Left with Emma Vigeland. There's a full hour-ish conversation with Emma and I talking about stuff. You can also listen to it as a podcast, search Power Report wherever you get podcasts. And follow me on the Twitter, the one on the screen, because I am vain. Dan from the web, that's the one.
Awesome. Okay, thank you, Ben. Have a good one. Much of the conversation about the Biden administration's domestic agenda going forward is focused on a few key bills, especially infrastructure and his American Families Plan. But we're also facing in just a few weeks the proposed deadline for doing something about police reform. And so we want to touch base with that effort, see who's working on it and how likely it is to happen in the originally declared timeline. So we're very lucky to be joined on the show once again by senior reporter for Insider covering the Justice Department and federal courts. Camila Deschalles joins us once again. Camila, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Very glad to have you back on. So you have a recent article breaking down the 16 key players, and it is really a bunch of people that range across the political spectrum. So who are some of the standout individuals that are working on this that you think are really going to help to shape whatever legislation comes out of this process?
Well, it's really across the board. I think a lot of people are focused on Congress that they should be the senators, like Republican Senator Tim Scott from South Carolina or Karen Bass of California, who, you know, got her legislation on police reform passed through the House, and now everybody's kind of looking at her to see how she's going to participate in these Senate talks. But there's also a lot of outside forces that I don't think a lot of people take into account, you know, heads of police unions who really want to see more protections for police officers within the bill. You also have, you know, activists within the Black Lives Matter movement who have also just played a really strong role in getting the topic of police brutality and police reform to the forefront of the national conversation. They also want a seat at the table. Like, you look at lawmakers like Cori Bush of Missouri. She's a really key player who has stated very vocally that she will not support any legislation that comes her way if they have, you know, the doctrine of qualified immunity that protects police officers from being sued. And she's stated off the bat that she would not support any type of legislation that would give those type of protections to police officers. So it's a very controversial issue, and you want to try to appease not only Republicans to get them to try to sign on the bill, but also Democrats who have, you know, been supporting efforts on police reform for years.
Yeah, that is fascinating. And I'm glad that you, you know, acknowledge there's these different groups, which obviously are going to fight for the things they want. But the idea that after a year of this social movement and the focus on Derek Chauvin's trial and all of that, like, what would come out of it is we really need to provide some more protections to police officers. That feels a little bit disconnected from what people seem to want. But so you have obviously people with very different objectives, as you've talked about. How much do we know about the current state of the bill? I mean, we've got, what, 2 weeks until we're supposed to see it in theory. Is that looking likely at this point?
The conversations, especially on Capitol Hill, still remain ongoing. You hear a lot of reporters trying to ask lawmakers like Cory Booker, you know, Tim Scott, Karen Bass, other key players on Capitol Hill about, you know, what are things that they're willing to compromise on. And, you know, what we heard last week was Lindsey Graham saying that he was willing to compromise on certain measures like qualified immunity, but he still wants at least some type of protection for police officers. A really big thing that seems to have consensus on both Democrats and Republicans is that they both agree that there should be some type of national database where, you know, people can report on crimes that are committed on police officers, or something, a database where, you know, they can kind of track if there was excessive use of force that police officers have used against civilians. And so that's been seen to be the battleground. I think the biggest thing that they want to try to find is consensus on certain issues and what they both can see can be in the bill, and that's not going to be contentious. But the issue of qualified immunity and, you know, what protections do you give police officers and what don't you, or what, you know, efforts to kind of roll back some of the protections are still kind of a contentious issue.
Yeah, so I'm trying to figure out going forward which path they could take. I mean, the cynic in me says no matter what they put in the bill or no matter what they strip out of the bill, they're not going to find 10 Republicans that are going to sign on to virtually anything. I'm assuming that I am wrong going forward. So which do you think is more likely, that they're going to have a very narrowly tailored, very far from radical bill of police reform that could maybe get together 10 Republican senators? Or do they go for something bolder that actually reflects what activists have been pushing for, knowing that in the short term they might not be able to get the votes, but then use that to generate pressure going forward? Which is it looking like that might be?
It's looking like the easiest way for them to try to get some Republican support is to pass a more narrow bill. And so what that looks like is to be a little bit more moderate, something that maybe progressives will just deem as not enough or insufficient. And I think that's what we're kind of heading towards, is that they're trying to take apart key issues that was in the last House bill and try to put them in there and try to build some type of consensus to get that Republican support. President Joe Biden has been very clear that he wants to make this a top priority. He wants to get this done before the end of the month. And realistically, a lot of Democratic and Republican lawmakers have acknowledged that in order to really do that in this short time frame, they need to kind of pass a bill that can draw some Republican support, that can get the 10 Republican support, you know, lawmakers to support it, that in order for it to actually pass in the Senate. But once it goes back to the House for another round of votes, they might, you know, counter some issues with more progressive Democrats who may feel that, you know, the bill doesn't include everything that it should.
Yeah, imagine, you know, them putting together some bare bones bill that the Biden administration can point to and say, hey, look, we're doing something. And then you have Representative Bush, you know, on TV every night talking about how it doesn't actually accomplish much. That would potentially hurt them. You mentioned Biden there. We haven't talked too much about him. You said that he's saying that this is going to be a priority. Is this something that over the past few weeks he's been talking about? Is he putting pressure on any of those key players that you've identified to craft the bill in any one of a few different ways? Is he actually involved in this process, I guess is what I'm asking.
From what we've been hearing, a lot of his advisors have been a part of the process. You have his senior advisor like Cedric Richmond, who was also a former congressman, that he's actively participating in these talks about criminal justice reform. And then you also have, you know, his domestic counsel advisor, Susan Rice, who is also, you know, weighed in on whether passing this bill was possible. And she's very optimistic that Congress can get something passed. This has been something that's been in the works for more than a year now. And Biden just really wants, and his administration want to see results, that Congress is committed to passing any type of legislation. And I think what's interesting here is that if they do pass this bill, that doesn't mean that it's the end, that, you know, more bills can be introduced to address different things when it comes to police reform. That topic itself is so huge, and there's so many areas in where you can reform policing practices. And so even if this is the one bill that gets passed this month, that doesn't mean this is the only bill that can be passed, you know, months moving forward.
I agree. I don't know. Makes me nervous though. Generally, they like to say, hey, we're done with that. But you are right. It's not impossible. In any event, for anyone watching this who would like more information about, again, we've only narrowly touched on a few of the individuals that are working on this. Camilla's article has 16 different key players. It's available right now at Insider with a lot of information about their background, what they might be pushing for. And you can really get a feel for how this process is about to play out if you read the article. Camilla, as always, we appreciate you joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.